Proper advice is caution. The house is well protected. The metallurgist who founded this should have been hanged. Indeed, probably was, thinks Cropper. Black copper, no less. Cheap tin. Temperatures all too cool. Favour me, Crocus. Peruse the scene in the street from yon door. If you spy a red and green merchant's wagon wobbling into town, Cropper would be much obliged for such information.
Crocus rose and crossed the room to the door. Opening it, he stepped outside and glanced around. Seeing no wagon in sight, the youth shrugged again and went back inside. He returned to the table.
No merchant wagon.
Ah, well,
Crapper said. He set down the coin on the table.
Altogether worthless, judges wise, Crapper. You may part with it at your leisure.
Crocus collected the coin and slipped it into his pocket.
No, I'm keeping it, for good luck.
Crapper looked up, his eyes bright, but Crocus had his attention on the mug in his hands. The fat man glanced away, sighing.
Crapper must needs depart immediately, if this eve's rendezvous is to be propitious for all involved.
Crocus drained his wine. We can head back together.
Excellent.
Crapper rose, pausing to brush crumbs from his chest.
Shall we be off, then?
He looked up to see Crocus frowning down at his hand.
Has something smitten the lad?
He asked quickly. Crocus started. He looked away guiltily, the colour rising in his face.
No,
he mumbled. He glanced again at his hand.
I must have picked up some wax somewhere,
he explained. He rubbed his hand on his leg and grinned sheepishly.
Let's go.
It will be a fine day for a walk, pronounces Crapper, who is wise in all things.
White Gold's Round encircled an abandoned tower with a panoply of brightly dyed awnings. The goldsmith merchant shops, each with their own security guards loitering outside, faced out on the round street, the aisles between them narrow cracks leading to the tower's ruined compound. The many tales of death and madness surrounding Hinter's Tower and its environs kept it empty, and, uppermost in the minds of the goldsmiths, an unlikely approach to their precious stores. As the afternoon waned toward dusk, the round's crowds thinned, and the private guards grew more wary. Iron grills rattled into place over storefronts here and there, and among the few that remained open, torches were ignited. Murillo entered the round from the third-tier road, pausing every now and then to examine a shopkeeper's wares. Wrapped in a shimmering blue cloak from the mallow waist, Murillo knew his ostentatious display of wealth would do much to allay suspicion. He came to one shop in particular, framed on either side by unlit stores. The goldsmith, narrow-faced and pebble-nosed, leaned hawkishly on his counter, his weathered hands before him bearing tiny grey scars that looked like raven tracks on mud. One finger tapped a restless beat. Murillo approached, meeting the man's beetle eyes.
Is this the shop of Crute of Taliant?
I'm Crute,
the goldsmith grated sourly, as if disgruntled with his lot in life.
Taliant pearls, set in blood gold from the mines of Moab and Belt. None other to be found in all Darujistan.
He leaned forward and spat past Murillo, who involuntarily stepped to one side.
No customers this day?
He asked, pulling a handkerchief from his sleeve and touching his lips.
Crute's gaze tightened. Only one, he said. Perused a cache of Goalis gems, rare as dragon's milk, and suckled from rock as grim. 100 slaves lost to each stone, prized from the angry veins.
Crute's shoulders jerked and his eyes darted.
Out the back, I keep them, lest temptation spatter the street with blood and like.
Murillo nodded.
Sound practice. Did he purchase any?
Crute grinned, revealing blackened stumps for teeth.
One, but not the best. Come, I'll show you.
He went to the side door and opened it.
Through here, then.
Murillo entered the shop. Black curtains covered the walls, and the air was musty with old sweat. Crute led him into the back room, which, if anything, was more rank and stifling than the first. The goldsmith dropped the curtain between the two rims and faced Murillo.
"Move, quickly. I've laid out a hoard of fool's gold and worthless stones on the counter up front. If any sharp-eyed customer marks them, this hole will be finished."
He kicked at the back wall, and a panel swung from its hinges.
"Crawl through, damn it, and tell Relic that the Guild is not pleased with his generosity regarding our secrets. Go!"
Murillo fell to his knees and pushed his way through the portal, the earthen floor damp beneath his hands and staining his knees. He groaned his distaste as the door swung down behind him, then climbed to his feet. Before him rose Hinter's Tower, its mould-ridden stone walls glistening in the dying light. An overgrown cobbled pathway led up to the arched entrance, bereft of a door and heavy with shadows. Of the chamber within, Murillo saw only darkness. Roots from the scraggy scrub oaks lining the path had pushed most of the cobbles up from the earth, making the way treacherous. After a cautious minute, Murillo arrived at the doorway. He narrowed his gaze and tried to pierce the darkness.
"Relic!" he hissed. "Where in Hood's name are you?"
A voice spoke behind him.
"You're late."
Murillo spun, a long, thin dueling rapier in his left hand rasping from its sheath, sweeping low into guard position, a main gauche appearing in his right hand as he dropped into a defensive crouch, then relaxed.
"Damn it, Relic!"
The assassin grunted in amusement, eyeing the rapier's razor-sharp tip, which had but a moment earlier hovered inches from his solar plexus.
"Good to see your reflexes have not dulled, friend. All that wine and those pastries seem not to have girdled you much."
Murillo resheathed his weapons.
"I expected to find you in the tower."
Eyes widening, Relic said,
"Are you mad? The place is haunted." "You mean that's not just a story you assassins made up to keep people away?"
Relic turned and made his way to a lower terrace that had once overlooked the garden. White stone benches squatted in the wiry yellow grass like the stained bones of some gargantuan beast. Below the terrace, Murillo saw, as he joined the assassin, sprawled a muddy, algae-filled pond. Frogs croaked and mosquitoes buzzed in the tepid air.
"Some nights," Relic said as he brushed dead leaves from one of the benches, "wraiths crowd the entrance. You can walk right up to them, listen to their pleas and threats. They all want out."
He sat down. Murillo remained standing, his gaze on the tower.
"What of Hinter himself? Does his wraith number among them?"
"No. The madman sleeps within, or so it's said. The wraiths are trapped in the sorcerer's nightmares. He holds on to them, and even Hood cannot draw them to his cold bosom. Do you wish to know where those wraiths have come from, Murillo?"
Relic grinned.
"Enter the tower, and you'll discover it firsthand."
Murillo had been about to go into the tower when Relic had surprised him.
"Thanks for the warning,"
he snapped sarcastically, gathering his cloak and sitting down. Relic waved the mosquitoes from his face.
"Well?"
"I have them," Murillo said. "Lady Orr's most trusted hand-servant delivered them this afternoon."
He removed from inside his cloak a bamboo tube tied in blue ribbon.
"Two invitations to Lady Simtal's fete, as promised."
"Good."
The assassin looked quickly at his friend. "You've not seen Crupper's nose twitch?"
"Not yet. Ran into him this afternoon. Seems Crocus is making some bizarre demands. Of course," Murillo added, scowling, "who can tell when Crupper's caught wind of something? In any case, I've seen nothing to suggest the slippery little gnome suspects we're up to anything."
"What was that you said about Crocus making bizarre demands?"
"A peculiar thing, that," Murillo mused. "When I dropped by the Phoenix Inn this afternoon, Crupper was delivering to the lad the pickings from his last job. Ah, surely Crocus hasn't abandoned Crupper as his fence. We all would have caught wind of that."
That was from an estate, wasn't it?
Whose? Ralik asked.
Dahl's, Murillo answered. Then his eyebrows rose. Kiss of Gedaron, the Dahl maiden, the ripe one with the cheeks. She's been shown at damn near every gathering. All the frilly lads leaving a trail for the mop boys. Oh, my. Our young thief is perchance smitten, and now keeps her baubles for himself. Of all the hopeless dreams a boy could have, he's reached for the worst.
Maybe, Ralik said quietly.
Maybe not.
A word to his uncle. Murillo's pained expression lifted.
A nudge in the right direction. Yes, finally, Mamet will be pleased.
Patience, Ralik interjected. Turning a thieving child into a man of standing and learning will require more work than a swooning heart will manage. Murillo frowned.
Well, forgive me for being so excited at the prospect of saving the lad's life.
Ralik's smile was soft.
Never regret such pleasure, he said.
Catching the assassin's tone, Murillo sighed, the sharp edges of his sarcasm sinking away.
It's been many years since we had so many things of hope to strive for, he said quietly.
The path to one will be bloody, Ralik said. Don't forget that.
But yes, it's been a long time. I wonder if Krupa even remembers such days.
Murillo snorted.
Krupa's memory is revised hourly. All that holds him together is fear of being discovered.
Ralik's eyes darkened.
Discovered?
His friend seemed far away, but then he collected himself and smiled.
Oh, warden suspicions, no more. He's a slippery one, is Krupa.
Ralik chuckled at Murillo's mocking syntax. He studied the pond before them.
Yes, he agreed after a time. He's the slippery one, all right.
He stood.
Kroot will be wanting to close up. The round's asleep by now.
Right. The two men left the terrace, methane mists swirling around their legs. As they reached the path, Murillo turned for a look at the tower's doorway, wondering if he could see the gibbering wraiths. But all he saw beneath the sagging arch was a wall of darkness. In some strange way, he found that more disturbing than any horde of lost souls he might imagine. Bright morning sunlight flowed in from the broad windows of Baruch's study, and a warm wind slipped into the room, carrying the smells and noises from the street below. The alchemist, still dressed in his nightclothes, sat on a high stool at the map table. He held a brush in one hand, dipping it now and again into an ornate silver inkwell. The red ink had been watered down. He painted wash on the map, covering the areas now held by the Malazan Empire. Fully one half of the map, the north half, was red. A small clear strip just south of Black Dog Forest marked Caladan Brood's forces, flanked on either side by two smaller patches indicating the Crimson Guard. The red wash surrounded these clear spots and extended down to engulf Pale, ending on the north edge of the Talin Mountains. The street noises had become quite loud, Baruch noted, as he leaned close to the map to paint the red tide's southern border. Construction work, he concluded, hearing the squeal of winches and a voice bellowing at passers-by. The sounds died away, then there came a loud crack. Baruch jumped, his right forearm jerking out and knocking over the inkwell. The red ink poured across his map. Cursing, Baruch sat back. His eyes widened as he watched the spreading stain cover Darujistan and continue south to Catlin. He stepped down from the stool, reaching for a cloth to wipe his hands, more than a little shaken by what could easily be taken as an omen. He walked across the chamber to the window, bent forward, and looked down. A crew of workers was busy tearing up the street directly below. Two burly men swung picks, while three others formed a line, passing the shattered cobblestones to a growing pile on the pavement. The foreman stood nearby, his back to a wagon, studying a parchment scroll. Baruch frowned.
"Who's in charge of road maintenance?" he wondered aloud.
A soft knock diverted his attention.
"Yes?"
His servant, Roald, took a single step into the room.
"One of your agents has arrived, Lord."
Baruch flicked a glance at the map table.
"Have him wait a moment, Roald."
"Yes, Lord."
The servant stepped back and closed the door. The alchemist walked over to the table and rolled up the ruined map. From the hallway came a loud voice followed by a murmur. Baruch slid the map onto a shelf and turned in time to see the agent enter. On his trail, a scowling Roald. Waving at Roald to leave, Baruch gazed down at the gaudily dressed man.
"Good day, Cropper."
Roald stepped out and softly shut the door.
"More than good, Baruch, dear friend of Cropper. Truly wonderful. Have you partaken of the morn's fresh air?"
Baruch glanced at the window.
"Unfortunately," he said, "the air outside my window has become rather dusty."
Cropper paused. His arms returned to his sides. Then he reached into a sleeve and withdrew his handkerchief. He patted his brow.
"Ah, yes, the road workers. Cropper passed them on his way in. A rather belligerent lot, thinks Cropper. Indeed rude, but hardly exceptional for such menial labourers."
Baruch gestured to a chair. With a beatific smile, Cropper sat.
"Such a hot day,"
he said, eyeing the carafe of wine on the mantelpiece. Ignoring this, Baruch strode to the window, then turned his back to it. He studied the man, wondering if he would ever catch a glimpse of what lay beyond Cropper's cherubic demeanor.
"What have you heard?" he asked softly.
"What has Cropper heard? What hasn't Cropper heard?"
Baruch raised an eyebrow.
"How about brevity?"
The man shifted in the chair and mopped his forehead.
"Such heat!"
Seeing Baruch's expression harden, he continued.
"Now, as for news..."
He leaned forward, his voice falling to a whisper.
"'Tis muttered in corners in the bars, in dark doorways of dank streets, in the nefarious shadows of nocturnal night, in—"
"Get on with it."
"Yes, of course. Well, Cropper has caught wind of a rumour. An assassin's war, no less. The guild is taking losses, 'tis said."
Baruch turned back to the window, his eyes on the street below.
"And where do the thieves stand?"
"The rooftops are getting crowded. Throats are being slit. Profits have plummeted."
"Where's Ralick?"
Cropper blinked.
"He's disappeared," he said. "Cropper has not seen him in days."
"This assassin's war, it isn't internal?"
"No."
"Has this new force been identified then?"
"No."
Baruch's gaze intensified. Below, the street workers seemed to spend more time arguing than working. An assassin's war could be trouble. Vorkan's guild was strong, but the Empire was stronger, if indeed these newcomers were claws. But something felt decidedly odd about the whole thing. In the past, the Empress used such local guilds, often recruited from them. The alchemist could discern no purpose behind such a war, and that was even more disturbing to him than the war itself. Hearing a shuffling behind him, he remembered his agent. He turned and smiled.
"You can go now."
Something flashed in Cropper's eyes that startled Baruch. The fat man rose in a single fluid motion.
"Cropper has more to tell, Master Baruch."
Bemused, the alchemist nodded for Cropper to continue.
"The tale is arduous and confused, alas,"
he said, striding to join Baruch at the window. His handkerchief had disappeared.
"Cropper can only surmise, as best a man of innumerable talents may, in moments of leisure, during games of chance and the like. In the aura of the twins, an adept may hear, see, smell, and touch things as insubstantial as the wind. A taste of Lady Luck, the bitter warning of the Lord's laughter."
Cropper's gaze snapped to the alchemist.
Do you follow, master?
His eyes riveted on the man's round face, Baruch said quietly,
You speak of Opon.
Crupper looked back down at the street.
Perhaps a grim feint meant to mislead such a foolish Crupper.
Foolish? Baruch smiled inwardly.
Not this man.
Who can say?
Crupper raised a hand, showing in his palm a flat disc of wax.
An item,
he said softly, his eyes on the disc,
that passes without provenance, pursued by many who thirst for its cold kiss, on which life and all that lay within life is often gambled. Alone, a beggar's crown. In great numbers, a king's folly. Weighted with ruin, yet blood washes from it beneath the lightest rain, and to the next, no hint of its cost. It is as it is, says Crupper, worthless, but for those who insist otherwise.
Baruch was holding his breath. His lungs burned, yet it was an effort to release them. Crupper's words had drawn him into something, a place, hinting of vast stores of knowledge, and the sure, unfailing, precise hand that had gathered it, marked it on parchment. A library, shelves of black wood in sharp relief, tomes bound to shiny leather, yellowed scrolls, a pitted, stained desk. Baruch felt he had but stolen a single glance into this chamber. Crupper's mind, the secret place with its door locked to all but one.
You speak, Baruch said slowly, fighting to pull back into reality by focusing on the wax disc in Crupper's hand. Of a coin.
Crupper's hand snapped shut. He turned and set the disc down on the windowsill.
Examine this semblance, Master Baruch. It marks both sides of a single coin.
The handkerchief reappeared, and Crupper stepped back, dabbing his brow.
My, but it is hot, says Crupper.
Help yourself to some wine, Baruch murmured.
As the man left his side, the alchemist opened his warren. He gestured, and the wax disc rose into the air, slowly moving to hover before him at eye level. He studied the imprint facing him.
The lady,
he muttered, nodding. The disc turned, revealing to him the Lord. The disc turned again, and Baruch's eyes widened as it began spinning. A whirring sound filled the back of his head. He felt his warren resisting a pressure that grew with the sound, then his source collapsed. Faintly, as if from a great distance, he heard Crupper speak.
Even in this semblance, Master Baruch, blows the twin's breath. No mage's warren can withstand that wind.
The disc still spun in the air in front of Baruch, a silver blur. A fine mist expanded around it. Hot droplets spat at his face and he stepped back. Blue fire flickered from the melting wax, the disc dwindling rapidly. A moment later, it vanished, and the spinning sound and its accompanying pressure stopped abruptly. The sudden silence filled Baruch's head with pain. He laid a trembling hand on the windowsill for support, then closed his eyes.
Who carries the coin, Crupper?
His voice rasped from his constricted throat.
Who?
Crupper once again stood at his side.
A lad,
he answered casually.
Known to Crupper, assuredly so, as well as to your other agents. Murillo, Ralik, and Cole?
Baruch's eyes reopened.
That can't be a coincidence,
he hissed, a desperate hope rising to struggle against the terror he felt. Opon had entered the gambit, and in such reaches of power, the life of a city and those within it meant nothing. He glared at Crupper.
Gather the group, then, all you've named. They've served my interests for a long time, and they must do so now, above all other concerns. Do you understand me? Crupper will convey your insistence. Ralik, perchance, is bound to guild duties, while Kol, given purpose in life once again, might well steady his gaze and tread and take this mission to heart. Master Baruch, what is the mission, by the way?
Protect the coin-bearer. Watch him. Mark whose face rests on him, benign or foul. I must know if the lady has him, or the lord. And, Crupper, for this, find Ralik. If the lord claims the coin-bearer, the assassin's talents will be required. Crupper blinked.
Understood. Alas, may mercy smile upon young Crocus.
Crocus? Baruch frowned. That's a name I know.
Crupper's face remained blank.
Never mind. Very well, Crupper.
He turned back to the window once again.
Keep me informed.
As always, Baruch, Crupper's friend.
The man bowed.
And thank you for the wine. It was most delicious.
Baruch heard the door open, then close. He gazed down the street. He had managed to clamp a hold on his fear. Opon had a way of making ruins of the most finely wrought plans. Baruch despised that prospect of chance operating in his affairs. He could no longer rely on his ability to predict, to prepare contingencies, to work out every possibility, and seek out the one best suited to his desires.
As the coin spun, thus the city.
Added to this, the mysterious ways of the Empress. Baruch rubbed his brow. He'd have to instruct Roel to bring him some healing tea. His headache was reaching debilitating proportions. As he brought his hand down past his face, his eyes caught a flash of red. He raised both palms into view. Red ink stained them. He leaned forward on the windowsill. Through a sparkling cloud of dust, Darujistan's rooftop sprawled, and the harbor beyond.
"And you, Empress," he whispered. "I know you're here somewhere. Your pawns move unseen as yet, but I will find them. Be sure of that, with or without Opon's damned luck."
Book 3. The Mission. Marionettes dance afield beneath masterly hands. I stumble among them, crossed by the string's entangled two-step, and curse all these fools in their mad pirouette. I shall not live as they do. Oh no, leave me in my circled dance. These unbidden twitchings, you see, I swear on Hood's grave, is artistry in motion. Sayings of the Fuel. Theny Buell. Birthdate unknown. Chapter 8. He stepped down then among women and men, the sigil stripped in her foul cleansing. There on the blood-soaked sand spilled the lives of Emperor and First Sword. So tragic this treachery. He was of the old guard, commanding the honed edge of Empire's fury. And so in stepping down but not away, he remained the remembrance before her eyes. The curse of conscience she would not stand. A price was placed before him, that he glanced over in first passing, unknowing and so unprepared, in stepping down among women and men. He found what he'd surrendered, and damned its reawakening. The Bridge Burners. Tok the Younger. A quarter hour before dawn, the sky held the color of iron shot through with streaks of rust. Sergeant Whiskey Jack squatted on a dome of bedrock up from the pebble beach, gazing out over the misty calm surface of Lake Azure. Far to the south, on the lake's opposite shore, rose the faint glow of Darujistan. The mountain crossing of the night just past had been unpleasant, the Qual tossed about in the midst of three warring thunderheads. It was a miracle no one had been lost. The rain had since stopped, leaving the air cool and clammy. He heard the sound of boots, accompanied by a clicking noise behind him. Whiskey Jack turned and straightened. Kalam and a black Maranth approached, picking their way through the mossy tumble of rocks at the base of the slope. Behind them rose the shadowed redwood forest, the patched trunks standing like bearded sentinels against the mountainside. The sergeant drew a deep breath of the chill morning air.
"Everything's fine," Kalam said. "The green Maranth delivered as ordered, and more. Fiddler and Hedge are two happy sappers."
Whiskey Jack raised an eyebrow. He turned to the black Maranth.
"I thought your munitions were getting scarce."
The creature's face remained in shadow beneath the hinged helmet. The words that came from it seemed born from a cavern, hollow and faintly echoing.
"Selectively, bird that steals. You are well known to us, Bridgeburner. You tread the enemy's shadow. From the Maranth, assistance will never be scarce."
Surprised, Whiskey Jack looked away, the skin tightening around his eyes. The Maranth continued.
"You asked of the fate of one of our kind, a warrior with but one arm, who fought at your side in the streets of Nathilog many years ago. He lives still."
The sergeant took a deep breath of the sweet forest air.
"Thank you," he said.
"We wish that the blood you next find on your hands is your enemy's, bird that steals."
He frowned, then gave a brusque nod and turned his attention back to Kalam. "What else?" The assassin's face became expressionless.
"Quick, Ben's ready," he said.
"Good. Gather the others. I'll be laying out my plan."
"Your plan, Sergeant?"
"Mine," Whiskey Jack said firmly.
"The one devised by the Empress and her tacticians is being rejected, as of now. We're doing it my way. Get going, Corporal."
Kalam saluted, then left. Whiskey Jack stepped down from the rock, his boots sinking into the moss.
"Tell me, Maranth, might a squadron of your black be patrolling this area 2 weeks from now?"
The Maranth's head swiveled audibly toward the lake.
"Such unscheduled patrols are common. I expect to command one myself in 2 weeks' time."
Whiskey Jack gazed steadily at the black armored warrior standing beside him.
"I'm not quite sure how to take that," he said eventually.
The warrior faced him.
"We are not so unalike," he said. "In our eyes, deeds have measure. We judge. We act upon our judgments. As in Pale, we match spirit with spirit."
The sergeant frowned.
"What do you mean?"
18,739 souls departed in the Purge of Pale. One for each Maranth confirmed as a victim of Pale's history of enmity toward us. Spirit with spirit, bird that steals."
Whiskey Jack found he had no response. The Maranth's next words shook him deeply.
"There are worms within your empire's flesh, but such degradation is natural in all bodies. Your people's infection is not yet fatal. It can be scoured clean. The Maranth are skilled at such efforts."
"How exactly?" Whiskey Jack paused, choosing his words carefully. "Do you intend this scouring?" He recalled the wagons piled with corpses, winding out of Pale, and struggled against the ice, tingling along his spine.
"Spirit with spirit,"
the Maranth answered, returning his attention to the city on the south shore.
"We depart for now. You will find us here in 2 weeks' time, bird that steals."
Whiskey Jack watched the black Maranth walk away, pushing through the thickets surrounding the clearing where his riders waited. A moment later, he heard the rapid thud of wings, then the call rose above the trees. The Maranth circled once overhead, then turned north, slipping between the bearded boles and heading upslope. The sergeant sat down on the bedrock again, his eyes on the ground as the members of his squad arrived, hunkering down around him. He remained silent, seeming unaware that he had company, his brow furrowed and jaw bunching as he ground his molars with a slow, steady precision.
"Sarge,"
Fiddler said quietly. Startled, Whiskey Jack looked up. He drew a deep breath. Everyone had gathered with the exception of Quick Ben. He'd leave Kalam to fill in the wizard later.
"All right. The original plan's been scrapped, since it was intended to get us all killed. I didn't like that part, so we'll do it my way, and hopefully get out alive."
"We ain't going to mine the city gates?"
Fiddler asked, glancing at Hedge.
"No," the sergeant answered. "We'll put those Moranth munitions to better use. Two objectives, two teams. Kalam will lead one, and with him will be Quick Ben and..." He hesitated. "And sorry. I'll lead the other team. The first task is to get into the city unnoticed, out of uniform." He looked to Mallet. "I take it the green delivered?"
The healer nodded.
"It's a local make, all right. 18-foot fisher, 4 oars, should get us across the lake easy enough. Even a couple of nets included."
"So, we'll do some fishing," Whiskey Jack said. "Coming into the harbor without a catch would look suspect. Anybody here ever fished?"
There was silence. Then Sorry spoke up.
"I have. A long time ago."
Whiskey Jack stared at her, then said,
"Right. Pick whoever you need for that."
Sorry smiled mockingly. Whiskey Jack pulled his gaze from hers, with an oath under his breath. He eyed his two saboteurs.
"How much munitions?"
2 crates,
Hedge replied, adjusting his leather cap. "Cuss us all the way down to smokers."
"We could cook a palace,"
Fiddler added, shifting about excitedly.
"Good enough," Whiskey Jack said. "All right. Everyone listen and pay attention, or we won't come out of this alive."
In a secluded glade in the forest, Quick Ben poured white sand in a circle and sat down in its center. He took 5 sharpened sticks and set them in a row before him, pushing them to various depths in the loam. The center stick, the highest, rose about 3 feet. The ones on either side stood at 2 feet, and the outer ones at 1 foot. The wizard uncoiled a yard's length of thin gut string. He took one end and fashioned a scaled-down noose, which he tightened over the center stick near the top. He ran the line to the left, looping it once over the next shaft, then crossed over to the right side and looped it again. He brought the string across to the far left stick, muttering a few words as he did so. He wrapped it twice and brought it over to the far right stick, where he tied a knot and cut the trailing string. Quick Ben leaned back and folded his hands on his lap. A frown creased his brow.
"Hairlock!"
An outer stick twitched, turned slightly, then fell still.
"Hairlock!"
He barked again. All 5 shafts jerked. The center one bent toward the wizard. The string tautened, and a low-pitched hum emanated from it. A cold wind swept across Quick Ben's face, stripping away the beads of sweat that had gathered in the last minute. A rushing sound filled his head, and he felt himself falling through dark caverns, their unseen walls ringing in his ears as if iron hammers clanged against the rock. Flashes of blinding silver light stung his eyes, and the wind pulled at the skin and flesh of his face. In some shielded part of his mind, he retained a sense of distance, of control. Within this calm, he could think, observe, analyze.
"Hairlock," he whispered. "You've gone too far. Too deep. This warren has swallowed you, and will never spit you out. You're losing control, Hairlock."
But these thoughts were for him alone. He knew the puppet was still distant. He watched himself continue, spinning, whirling through the caverns of chaos. Hairlock was compelled to match him, only upward. Abruptly, he found himself standing. Beneath his feet, the black rock seemed to swirl, cracked here and there in its slow convolutions by bright, glowing red. Looking around, he saw that he stood on a spire of rock, rising at an angle, its jagged apex a dozen feet in front of him. Turning, his gaze followed the spire as it sank down and out of sight, lost to billowing yellow clouds. A moment of vertigo gripped Quick Ben. He tottered, then as he regained his balance, he heard a chuckle behind him. He turned to see Hairlock perched atop the apex, his wooden body smeared and scorched, the doll's clothing ripped and frayed. Quick Ben asked,
"This is the spire of Andy, isn't it?"
Hairlock's round head bobbed.
"Halfway. Now you know how far I have gone, wizard. To the very foot of the warren, where power finds its first shape, and all is possible."
"Just not very likely,"
Quick Ben said, eyeing the marionette.
"How does it feel, standing in the middle of all that creation, but unable to touch it, to use it? It's too alien, isn't it? It burns you with every reach."
"I'll master it," Hairlock hissed. "You know nothing. Nothing."
Quick Ben smiled.
"I've been here before, Hairlock."
He scanned the swirling gases around them, scudding on contrary winds.
"You have been lucky," he said. "Though they are few in number, there are creatures who call this realm home."
He paused and turned his smile on the puppet.
"They dislike intruders. Have you seen what they do to them? What they leave behind?"
The wizard's smile broadened at seeing Hairlock's involuntary jerk.
"So you have," he said quietly.
"You are my protector," Hairlock snapped. "I'm bound to you, wizard. The responsibility is yours, nor will I hide the fact if I am taken."
"Bound to me indeed."
Quick Ben lowered himself to his haunches.
"Good to hear your memories come back. Tell me, how fares Tattersail?"
The puppet slumped, looking away.
"Her recovery is a difficult one."
Quick Ben frowned.
"Recovery? From what?"
"The hound gear tracked me."
Hairlock shifted uneasily.
"There was a skirmish."
A scowl grew on the wizard's face.
"And?"
The puppet shrugged.
"Gear fled, sorely wounded by a mundane sword in the hands of that captain of yours. Tayshrin then arrived, but Tattersail had slipped into unconsciousness by then, so his search for answers was thwarted. But the fire of suspicion has been stoked beneath him. He sends out his servants, and they stalk the warrens. They hunt for signs of who and what I am. And why? Tayshrin knows your squad is involved. He knows that you're trying to save your own skins."
The puppet's mad gaze flickered.
"He wants you all dead, wizard. And as for Tattersail, perhaps he hopes her fever will kill her so he won't have to. But there is much he'd lose if she died without his questioning her first. No doubt he'd seek out her soul. He'd pursue what she knows into Hood's own realm. But she'd know enough to be elusive."
"Shut up for a minute," Quick Ben ordered. "Back to the beginning. You said Captain Parron stabbed Gear with his sword?"
Hairlock scowled.
"I did. A mortal weapon. It shouldn't have been possible. He may well have dealt the hound a fatal wound."
The puppet paused, then growled.
"You've not told me everything, wizard. There are gods involved in this. If you keep me in such ignorance, I might well stumble into the path of one of them."
He spat.
"A slave to you is bad enough. Do you think you could challenge a god for mastery of me? I'd be taken, turned, perhaps even..."
Hairlock unsheathed one of his small knives.
"Used against you."
He advanced a step, a dark glitter in his eyes. Quick Ben raised an eyebrow. Inside, his heart lurched in his chest. Was it possible? Would he not have detected something? A flavor? A hint of immortal presence?
"One last thing, wizard,"
Hairlock murmured, taking another step.
"Tattersail's fever crested just this night past. She screamed something about a coin that had spun. But now it has fallen, it has bounced, it has entered someone's hand. You must tell me about this coin. I must have your thoughts, wizard.
The puppet stopped suddenly and looked down at the knife in his hand. Herlock hesitated, seeming confused, then sheathed the weapon and squatted.
What's so important about a coin?
He growled.
Nothing. The bitch raved. She was stronger than I'd thought.
Quick Ben froze. The puppet seemed to have forgotten that the wizard was present. The thoughts he now heard were Herlock's own. He realized he was looking through the shattered window into the puppet's insane mind. And it was there that all the danger lay. The wizard held his breath as Herlock continued, its eyes fixed on the clouds below.
Gear should have killed her, would have, if not for that idiot captain. What irony! He now tends to her and puts his hand to his sword whenever I seek to come near. He knows I would snuff her life in an instant. But that sword, what god plays with this fool noble?
The puppet spoke on, but his words dwindled into inaudible mumbles. Quick Ben waited, hoping for more, though what he had already heard was enough to set his heart pounding. This mad creature was unpredictable, and all that held him in check was a tenuous control, the strings of power he had attached to Herlock's wooden body. But with this kind of madness came strength. Enough strength to break those strings? The wizard was no longer as sure of his control as he had been. Herlock had fallen silent. His painted eyes still flickered with black flame, the leaking of chaotic power. Quick Ben took a step forward.
Pursue Tayshrin's plans,
he commanded. Then he kicked hard. The toe of his boot struck Herlock's chest and sent the puppet spinning. Herlock flew out over the edge, then fell downward. His outraged snarl dwindled as he disappeared into the yellow clouds. Quick Ben drew a deep breath of the thick, stale air. He hoped that his abrupt dismissal had been enough to skew Herlock's recollections of the past few minutes. Still, he felt those strings of control growing ever more taut. The more this warren twisted Herlock, the more power he would command. The wizard knew what he'd have to do. Herlock had given it to him, in fact. Still, Quick Ben wasn't looking forward to it. The taste of sour bile rose into his mouth, and he spat over the ledge. The air stank of sweat, and it was a moment before he realized it was his own. He hissed a curse.
Time to leave, he muttered.
He raised his arms. The wind returned with a roar, and he felt his body flung up, up into the cavern above, then the next. As the caverns blurred by, a single word clung to his thoughts, a word that seemed to twist around the problem of Herlock like a web. Quick Ben smiled, but it was a smile responding to terror. And the word remained Gear. And with that name, the wizard's terror found a face. Whiskey Jack rose amid silence. The expressions arrayed around him were sober, eyes downcast or fixed elsewhere, closed into some personal, private place where swam the heaviest thoughts. The lone exception was Sorry, who stared at the sergeant with bright, approving eyes. Whiskey Jack wondered who was doing the approving within those eyes. Then he shook his head, angry that something of Quick Ben and Kalam's suspicions had slipped into his thoughts. He glanced away to see Quick Ben approaching. The wizard looked tired, an ashen tint to his face. Whiskey Jack's gaze snapped to Kalam. The assassin nodded.
Everyone, look alive, he said. Load up the boat and get it ready.
Mallet leading the way, the others headed down to the beach. Waiting for Quick Ben to arrive, Kalam said,
The squad looks beat, Sergeant. Fiddler, Trotz, and Hedge moved enough dirt in those tunnels to bury the Empire's dead. I'm worried about them. Mallet, he seems to be holding together so far. Still, whatever Surrey knows about fishing, I doubt any one of us could row their way out of a bathtub. And we're about to try crossing a lake, damn near big as a sea.
Whiskey Jack's jaw tightened. Then he forced a casual shrug into his shoulders.
You know damn well that any warrant opening anywhere near the city will likely be detected. No choice, Corporal. We row. Unless we can rig up a sail.
Kalam grunted.
Since when does the girl know about fishing?
The sergeant sighed.
I know. Came out of nowhere, didn't it?
Bloody convenient.
Quick Ben reached the dome of rock. Both men fell silent at seeing his expression.
I'm about to propose something you're going to hate,
the wizard said.
Let's hear it, Whiskey Jack replied, in a voice empty of feeling.
10 minutes later, the three men arrived on the slick, pebbled beach, both Whiskey Jack and Kalam looking shaken. A dozen yards from the water's edge sat the fisher boat. Trotz was straining on the rope attached to the prow hook, gasping and moaning as he leaned forward with all his weight. The rest of the squad stood in a clump off to one side, quietly discussing Trot's futile efforts. Fiddler chanced to look up. Seeing Whiskey Jack marching toward them, he blanched.
Trotz!
The sergeant bellowed. The bar guest's face, woad tattoos stretched into illegibility, turned to Whiskey Jack with wide eyes.
Let go of the rope, soldier.
Kalam released an amused snort behind Whiskey Jack, who glared at the others.
Now, he said, his voice harsh. Since one of you idiots convinced everyone else that loading all the equipment into the boat when it's still onshore was a good idea, you can all man the rope and drag it into the lake. Not you, Trotz. You get inside. Get comfortable. There at the stern.
Whiskey Jack paused. He studied Sorry's expressionless face.
From Fiddler and Hedge, I expect this, but I thought I put you in charge of setting things up.
Sorry shrugged. Whiskey Jack sighed.
Can you rig us a sail?
There's no wind.
Well, maybe there will be,
Whiskey Jack said, exasperated.
Yes, Sorry answered. We have some canvas. We'll need a mast.
Take Fiddler and make one. Now the rest of you, get this boat into the water.
Trotz climbed inside and sat down at the stern. He stretched out his long legs and draped an arm over the splashboard. He bared his filed teeth in what might have been a smile. Whiskey Jack turned to a grinning Kalam and Quick Ben.
Well, he demanded, what are you waiting for?
The grins died. Chapter 9. Have you seen the one who stands apart, cursed in a ritual, sealing his kind? Beyond death the host amassed and whirling like a plague of pollen. He stands apart, the first among all, ever veiled in time, yet outcast and alone, a Talanai mass wandering like a seed unfallen. Lay of Onos Tulan, Tok the Younger. Tok the Younger leaned forward in his saddle and spat. It was his third day out from Pale, and he longed for the city's high walls around him. The rivy plain stretched out on all sides, cloaked in yellow grass that rippled in the afternoon wind, but otherwise featureless. He scratched the edges of the wound that had taken his left eye, and muttered under his breath. Something was wrong. He should have met her 2 days past. Nothing was going as planned these days. What with Captain Parron vanishing before even meeting Whiskey Jack, and the story making the rounds about a hound attacking the second's last surviving mage and leaving 14 dead marines in its wake. He supposed he shouldn't be surprised that this rendezvous had gone awry as well. Chaos seemed a sign of the times. Tok straightened and rose in his saddle. Though there was no true road as such on the plain, merchant caravans had mapped a rough track running north-south along the western edge. Trade had since died out,
but the passing of generations of wagons and horse trains had left its mark. The center of the plain was home to the Rivi, those small brown-skinned people who moved with the herds in a seasonal cycle. Though not warlike, the Malazan Empire had forced their hand, and now they fought and scouted alongside Caladan Brood's Tista Andi legions against the Empire. Maranth reports placed the Rivi far to the north and east, and Tok was thankful for that. He was feeling very alone out in this wasteland, yet loneliness was a lesser evil, all things considered. Tok's single eye widened. It seemed he wasn't so alone after all. Perhaps a league ahead, ravens wheeled. The man cursed and loosened the scimitar sheathed at his hip. He fought the urge to push his horse into a gallop and settled for a quick trot. As he neared, he saw trampled grass off to one side of the trader's track. The cackling laughter of the ravens was the only sound to break the stillness. They had already begun feeding. Tok reined in his horse and sat unmoving in his saddle, hunched forward. None of the bodies he saw looked as if they were apt to start moving, and the ravens' preoccupied squabbling was good evidence that any survivors had long gone. Still, he had a bad feeling about this. Something hung in the air, something between a smell and a taste. He waited, for what he wasn't certain, but a reluctance to move gripped him. All at once, he identified the strangeness he felt. Magic. It had been unleashed here.
"I hate this," he muttered, then dismounted.
The ravens gave him room, but not much. Ignoring their outraged shrieks, he approached the bodies. They numbered 12 in all. 8 wore the uniforms of Malazan Marines, but these weren't average soldiers. His gaze narrowed on the silver sigils on their helmets.
"Jakardakan," he said.
"Elites. They'd been cut to pieces." He turned his attention to the remaining bodies and felt a tremor of fear run through him. No wonder that Jakardakan had taken such a beating. Tok strode to one of the bodies and crouched beside it. He knew something of the clan markings among the Barghast, how each hunter group was identified through their woad tattooing. The breath hissed between his teeth, and he reached out to turn the savage's face toward him. Then he nodded. These were Ilgri's clan. Before the Crimson Guard had enlisted them, their home territory had been 1,500 leagues to the east, among the mountains just south of the Porul. Slowly, Tok rose. The Ilgreys numbered among the strongest of those who had joined the Crimson Guard at Black Dog Forest, but that was 400 leagues north. So what had brought them here? The stench of spilled magic wafted across his face, and he turned, his eye fixing on a body he hadn't noticed before. It lay beside scorched grass.
"So," he said, "my question's answered."
This band had been led by a Barghast shaman. Somehow, they'd stumbled onto a trail, and this shaman had recognized it for what it was. Tok studied the shaman's body, killed by a sword wound in the throat. The unleashing of sorcery had been the shaman's, but no magic had opposed him. And that was odd, particularly since it was the shaman who had died, rather than whomever he had attacked. Tok grunted.
"Well, she's said to be tough on mages."
He walked a slow circle around the kill site and found the trail with little difficulty. Some of the Jakardakan had survived, and from the smaller set of boot prints, so had their charge. And overlaying these tracks were half a dozen moccasin prints. The trail veered westerly from the trader's track, yet still led south. Returning to his horse, Tok mounted and swung the animal around. He removed the short bow from its saddle holster and strung it, then nocked an arrow. There was no hope of coming up on the Barghast undetected. Out on this plain, he'd be visible a long time before entering arrow range, and that range had become much closer now that he'd lost an eye. So they'd be waiting for him, with those damn lances. But he knew he had no choice. He hoped only to take down one or two before they skewered him. Cox spat again, then wrapped the reins around his left forearm